There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, I'm Matt Cholley and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up today, it's a Wednesday, but no PMQs unpacked because they're still on recess. So instead, we bring you classic PMQs unpacked. Rewinding the clock to December 2005, David Cameron's debut as Conservative leader up against Tony Blair. Genuinely fascinating, both his approach to it and the topics he chose. And somebody mentions Taunton, so that's some good news. Before that, in The Columnists, Alice Thompson and Robert Crampton on this major new report reviewing gender identity treatment for children. A lot of political reaction to that. We'll also talk potholes as well. And if you like what you hear on the podcast, don't forget you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. So much going on today.
A major capital letters big news story.
Yeah, Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, issued this urgent statement.
Well, first of all, I just issue a fulsome apology to the Samba community.
Yeah, the Prime Minister's gone on LBC this morning to apologise for wearing trainers that the rest of us like. The Adidas ones with the stripy stripes on. Nice. Most of the Politics at the Boring Bits team have got at least one pair. I've got two pairs. Well, we're gonna probably get them cheap now, can't you? People will be flogging them off cheap. Yeah, so that's very important. So important the Prime Minister addressed that. In fact, the whole phone-in on LBC went really well.
Let's go to the next call. Louise is in the Rhondda Valley and you're through to the Prime Minister. Go ahead, Louise. Morning to you.
Good morning, Nick. Good morning, Prime Minister.
Hi, Rhondda.
Yeah, great. Really good. Well done, everyone. Elsewhere,
a major capital letters big news story.
Willie out. William Ragg has quit the Tory party after sharing MPs' phone numbers with a sexting scammer, although Willie out is what got him into trouble in the first place. And finally, an urgent correction.
I have to say that the only bed I've ever bounced up and down on with a famous person was Elton John's.
What?
In France. And for some reason, Thomas the Tank Engine videos were on the TV.
The Ringo Starr ones, or the
and, later. This was very early on. And so we there's a group of us, and we ended up not in his bed, but on his bed,
yeah,
watching these videos, having a great time.
With Elton.
With Elton.
Except it wasn't. No, this was from How to Win an Election yesterday. Peter Mandelson saying he was on Elton John's bed watching Thomas the Tank Engine. It was, in fact, this.
Postman Pat, Postman Pat, Postman Pat and his black and white cat.
Peter Mandelson getting in touch with an urgent correction because we want to make sure that everything on the How to Win an Election podcast is entirely accurate. But the big question is, why doesn't Elton John like Thomas the Tank Engine?
The train don't stop there anymore.
And that's the best joke you're getting today. My favourite Elton John song, of course. And when I told when I told Bernie Taupin. He shook me by the hand. So there we are. Me and Bernie Taupin, great friends. In fact, if you want more of that sort of content, if you want to come and see how to win an election live, we are doing a special live episode and you can come to Times Radio Towers. It's on Friday, May the 3rd. You need to be a Times subscriber. So if you are a Times subscriber, go to mytimesplus.co.uk. Click on events. You can register there. I think a couple hundred people can get in the building and you can register to watch it along online. The morning after the local elections, Peter Mandelson, Polly McKenzie, Daniel Finkelstein, live here at Times Radio Towers. And you can be here, but you have to go online to mytimesplus.co.uk, log in with your Times subscription, and then register on the events page. Come and see us, how to win an election live.
The Columnists with Ali Burt, Alice Thompson and Robert Crampton.
Yeah, they're both here. Alice Thompson and Robert Crampton, morning.
Morning.
How are we all?
Morning, yeah, good.
Yeah. Well, I'm feeling guilty about the samba community because I was made to write a large piece about sambas only a month ago and laid out all my sambas, and I am very much one, and so is Robert.
This is pre-Rishi Sunak.
Yes, I had to do four different photo shoots for them. I had to bring in hundreds of pairs of sambas from my friends to pretend.
And they were yours.
That they were all mine, so I looked like some sort of Imelda Marcos.
How many have you actually got?
I have actually got six or seven pairs of Adidas, I have to say.
Yes, I've got a couple of pairs of Adidas. How many have you got?
I like the Spezia
Adidas
ones.
As opposed to Adidas Samba. Yeah, about four pairs of Adidas, I think, and various T-shirts and stuff.
I mean, I know other trainers are available, but they are just very comfy.
Very comfy.
And it's the colours.
Yeah.
And the stripes.
Yeah. More on that as we get it. Right, let's turn our attention to what we're actually here to talk about. The CAS report, after 3.5 years, is this report to the care of young people with gender dysphoria. It's been published today. Looking at, well, on the it says on the front of the Times, say NHS review rejects use of puberty blockers. It found that there was no good evidence to support the global clinical practice of prescribing hormones to under 18s to halt puberty or transition to the opposite sex. Dr. Hilary Cass, who carried out the report, basically highlighting a whole load of shortcomings when it comes to the treatments, the fact that in almost every other part of healthcare, doctors go on the evidence. Mm-hmm. And this just doesn't seem to have been the case.
No, this seems to have become politicised. It's at an early stage. It's a real danger when medicine becomes politicised. I mean, we saw that. It's kind of sort of Soviet Union, isn't it? And the evidence was shaky or non-existent. Mm. And she has now said, quite rightly, it seems, that it needs to be stopped. I mean, it's fascinating stuff into the causes of it. I mean, I think in 1989, there were something like 10 kids presenting with gender dysphoria at this clinic. And then by 2009, that had only gone up a little bit into the dozens or scores, I think. And then suddenly, from 2009, it goes stratospherically up to 2,000. And rather than being mostly young boys thinking that they wanted to be girls, it's gone the other way around. And there does seem to be a link with viewing online pornography,
really,
which is if you are a young girl, prepubescent or early teenage girl, and you see some of the things available online, you might well think, I quite like to be a boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that seems to be what has happened, and it's happened in this country out of all proportion to equivalent countries.
So interesting that she's trying to get to the root cause as well as then try to do, looking at the medical reaction.
That's why I like the fact that she's had 3 years, Dr. Hilary Cass, because she's really looked at this properly. And I think there is also a connection with autism, with children with all sorts of mental health issues. And I think that was the problem, is that they weren't actually giving them proper advice, you weren't looking at the medical, the mental health issues as much as just trying to medicalise them. And I think we medicalise the children far too young. And she brings that out in the report, that what we needed to do was discuss with these children what they were feeling, how they were feeling, and give them a lot more support, and also the families a lot more support, because I think they found it very bewildering. And I think we just ran too fast in one direction, which was particularly down the medical route rather than looking at how they could get other support.
But the point is that she's making that, you know, this is very complicated. Teenagers are complicated. Mm. Then if they've got mental health problems, eating disorders, a whole load of things. And then part of the problem is that the services for those things have been massively hollowed out. And so it's sort of a whole load of people actually being well-meaning and wanting to help, and this is a solution.
Yes, I think it's a classic example of the wrong thing happening for the right reasons. Mm. People with good intentions, or mostly people with good intentions, coming up with what's at the extreme has been a disastrous result for hundreds of youngsters with kind of irreversible damage done to them, medical damage. And below that, you're looking at a whole bunch of people who were possibly just confused young children in difficult circumstances, and the evidence is that the disproportionately coming from, you know, broken homes and so forth, and who were then badly misdiagnosed, and their actual issue was not addressed.
Also, I think this became so much part of the culture wars, so it became very polarised, the issue about trans. And I think that made it even more difficult because it was so shrill and everyone was so emotive about it, when actually we probably should have stood back and looked at these children. And some people were very, very good at it and were, you know, they were pilloried for doing it. And I think that we should have much earlier been the grown-ups in the room and thought, how are we going to do this? What are we doing? Are we actually doing the right thing here?
Yeah, and it looks like a real shortcut, doesn't it? Somebody presents with something really complicated.
Yeah.
Or difficult. It might be, you know, it might be autism. It might be something. You might not be able to give it a label even. It's just childhood difficulty and adolescent confusion, and it looks like a shortcut. It doesn't say, your problem is that you actually want to be a boy, or you actually want to be a girl. Here's some drugs.
Also, I think we definitely made children sort of pink or blue. So we very much asexualized and give them a gender very young. So in our generation, you know, in the 70s and 80s, there was much less of that. You didn't get pink birthday cards. You didn't have to paint your nails. There was a sense that you could very easily be a tomboy or, you know, boys, actually, particularly in the 70s, you know, you could wear pretty much what you wanted as a child.
You know, if you go back 10, 15, 20 years, you know, Daily Mail particularly, all sort of full of that, you know, the sexualization, the adultification of children. And so is that the age at which you started doing all that stuff, you know, the way you dress and, you know, but that's been getting younger and younger. Yeah. So therefore, teenagers start having to think, well, what am I? In a way that you didn't, you know, let children be children and all that. But also, the thing that really struck me is the point you were making, Robert, is that this is mostly girls wanting to become boys.
Yeah, I must admit that I thought it was the other way around.
Exactly, because the national argument is all about what's J.K. Rowling saying in a row with a trans woman.
Yes.
But that's why I think it's so different, because I think that this issue is very different in a way from the national issue about trans, which tends to be more about prisons or sports. Or this is very much younger girls, and it's all more about binding and, you know, what they're doing. They don't actually want to grow up, quite a lot of these children. You can see that. They're panicked about all sorts of different issues. And this is just one area.
It's incredibly reactionary if you think about it, because if you're a young girl who isn't fitting that kind of Barbie stereotype, and you kind of quite like wearing jeans and you want to climb trees and so forth, that's absolutely cool and you should be able to do that. Yeah, yeah. And that's what we used to call the tomboy.
Yeah.
And, as Alice referenced, and instead, the stereotype is such that you're saying, well, if you don't like all that stuff, then you might actually be a boy or, you know, we might turn you into a boy.
We're going to make a decision now, which is going to change you for the rest of your life.
Yes, and then therefore that's when the puberty blockers thing comes in, because then they say, well, you don't have to make the decision now. You can have these drugs to give you time to think.
Also, I think quite a few of the children were gay, so I think there's that issue that we should be much more relaxed and expressive and let children talk about it, and we should be talking about it rather than the issue when they may get all their information from porn or from a playground. So we need to have more discussions with them. We need to be open with them. I just think that too much of it's undercover, and that we didn't even know what was going on often in these clinics, that we do need to discuss it all, but we do need to do it in a very rational, calm way.
And it goes to what I think, well, I don't know whether we're still talking about the whole social media phone thing or not, but it's that argument. William Hague was making it in his column last week about how we've essentially conducted a grotesque experiment on a generation. And what is happening in Florida now, we're going to see, you know, the idea of banning social media for... is going to happen here, and not before time, I think.
Also, I love those Ziploc bags that they have. So we've now, Helen Rumbler wrote about yesterday that you have a school where you put your phone into a Ziploc bag and you actually talk to each other. And I think that will help. I think we should just roll that out across the country.
I think now, in probably 5-10 years from now, we're going to think, why did we ever let mobile phones into schools in the first place? It's starting to look a bit bizarre.
We've talked about that before. I mean, my daughter's school, that, you know, it's not just that, it's that her entire school life is on there.
The homework, the good points, the bad points, all that.
I just don't think it's necessary.
Come back to an old-fashioned paper. Bring back bits of paper.
Or just come off social media. And with one bound, you are free. I mean, people say, oh, I'm getting hassled on social media, I'm getting vilified, I'm getting bullied. Don't do it.
Yeah, and you don't.
I don't. No. And I really don't feel...
You're all right.
I think I'm all right. I don't really feel the lack.
Yeah, but it's also other things with them. It's Snapchat, it's WhatsApp, there's lots of different issues. I think it's actually just not having a phone at all at school and not being able to use it. And then, you know, as Helen Rumbler said, that when they see snow, they're not taking photos of it, they're not chatting to each other's friends, they actually go out and look at it for the first time. And I thought that was amazing, that sense that actually they're actually properly looking at and playing with each other and even flirting.
Whenever you go to a thing where you have to put your phone away, I did the... what's it called? Crystal Maze, though, a few years ago. You know, when you go to there's a place in London, you basically go and play the Crystal Maze on a TV show, but you have to put your phone away. And it meant that you got completely into it. Because all you're thinking is about, rather than taking pictures, like, oh, it's just like the Crystal Maze.
I did a piece on Gen Z a couple of years ago and meeting a bunch of 25-year-olds. And I thought when I told them about my lack of social media, they would sort of consider me a terrible old dinosaur, and maybe they did. But what they actually expressed was kind of envy.
Yeah.
It was, oh, I wish I could do that. It was perception was that they actually couldn't live their life.
They literally couldn't step away from it.
And I think maybe it's not as difficult as they think it is.
But actually, I think most adults are probably on their phone as much as their children. So that's the problem. Yeah. So I think we're not fantastic role models. So I think we'd have to do it both ways. I think you have to actually say, it's not just the children. We need to find a way when everyone's communicating more with each other.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's a question. Should you get money if you win at the Olympics? World Athletics has just announced that there will be the first sport to give prize money at the Olympics. I think you get $50,000 if you win a gold. Mm. And at the next Olympics, you'll get money for silver and bronze.
It's absolutely bonkers, I think, because the fact is that everyone will go to the Olympics anyway without being bribed to do it. So why they think they need to have any money going into the Olympics now. And there is something special still about having an Olympic gold, silver or bronze. So I interviewed Roger Bannister and he broke the four-minute mile, but he never won an Olympic gold. And he really minded about that. I mean, that is the goal for a lot of people. So they don't think they need cash for it.
But and the other thing that occurred to me is if you do win a gold...
You can monetize it.
You can monetize it.
Yeah.
We were talking about this in the office. Producer Lewis said, maybe you should get money if you lose. As a sort of pat on the head...
I don't think Usain Bolt's particularly hard up.
No.
I mean, and I don't think it would have $50,000 would have made a great deal of difference either way. Yeah. It's difficult. I must admit, I thought amateurism had pretty much gone at the Olympics anyway. So I think the whole Corinthian ideal, which we obviously all admire and the rest of it, is probably... That ship has sailed.
Well, the trouble is...
Corinth.
Exactly. The idea we all buy into is it's all just people in loincloths running up mountains and all that. And it's all, you know, everyone's just doing it for the fun of it. Yeah. And actually, we know that the Olympics of the past has been one of the most corrupt organisations. And, you know, whether it's the way that you get awarded it or the number of people who die building the venues and then what happens afterwards and all of that stuff.
Yes. Plus, you don't think they're all just running down beaches anymore. That's what we need.
Just Vangelis.
Yeah. Yes.
Vangelis? Vangelis. I don't know how you pronounce it.
Yeah. I went to the... when I was in Barcelona last week, I went to the... stadium.
Oh, yeah.
Which I was really disappointed because it seemed to be being used. Barcelona were using it. I was led to believe it was like destitute.
The new camp is being redeveloped and Barcelona are meanwhile playing in the old Olympic stadium.
But also there's so many sports that I love in the Olympics I didn't really know about until we had them in London. The sort of minor sports that are fabulous. And
they could do with a bit of money.
And I suppose they could do with a bit of money. But on the other hand, I quite like the fact they are amateurs. So you get the sort of fencers or you get the kind of, you know...
Jockeys.
Yes, there's so many different things
not jockeys,
you can do.
No, not dressage jockeys. People. The
yeah,
the
we love
horses.
Skateboarders and all those sort of ones. Yeah. I don't think they really need money. I think they just want to go.
Yeah, although they do need money because we're famously very good at sitting down sports, aren't we, in Britain? You know, the rowing, sports where you sit down to do them.
That's good.
Horses.
Yeah.
Shoot, lying down into shooting. Cycling, sailing and rowing.
Yeah.
and that you often have to be quite well off to do those sports.
Does the long jump count as a sitting down sport?
It does. No, because you don't start. You end up sitting down. Don't you?
But then you only get the money if you get gold. So that's the problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, now what you're saying is actually you should put it into the grassroots.
Yes, I am saying that, really. Yeah.
I agree with that.
I think that somebody did a study, something like 40% of the medalists in 2012 from Britain were public school educated.
Yeah.
It's become a rich person's, so, you know, maybe...
But isn't also that thanks to John Major in the National Lottery? I don't actually know if that's true, but that's what everyone always says.
The lottery was a big help.
It sort of helped people on.
Actually,
part of my problem is that I think we spend quite a lot of money with these elite athletes, and actually what you want them to do is go and get everyone playing sport. You know, we have got an obesity problem, so I would prefer them to try and spend the money on getting everyone out and getting schools playing more sport. That it's great that you get these Olympic golds, but you know, they're quite few and far between, and we spend vast amounts of our sport budget on it.
Yep. Well, let's speak now to an amateur sportsman. Ben Thornbury's on the line. Hi, Ben.
Hi.
Now, tell us what sport is that you play.
Fishing.
But we've spoken before, haven't you? Because you played golf before and fishing this time, but on a specific venue.
Yeah, that's correct. So I played golf before down the high street and in the middle of the road, and that sorted the potholes out then. So now I've moved over to a bit of fishing.
So this is the potholes on your road, and you marked up all the holes as golf holes. But so are you saying they've now been filled?
Yeah, well, actually, it got the high street resurfaced, and they were refilled, and we have a nice, clean tarmac surface now, which the residents are obviously very happy.
I thought he was fishing in the potholes.
No, you are now fishing in potholes, aren't you?
But yeah, we're now fishing in potholes. Oh. So it's gone from golf to fishing. So we're doing a bit of everything.
What are you catching?
Some carp.
Sharks.
Publicity, that's what you're catching. So today the government's announced an extra £8.3 billion. It was going to be spent on HS2, which is going into potholes. As I say, when I've been going around on my tour, and I'm doing this thing, I ask the audience to come up with policies and they put them in the ballot box and then I read them out and the audience votes and by the end of the show we've got a policy. Potholes has come up more than anything else, Ben. Yeah. You're so... It's like the thing... It's so
it's
symbolic of everything.
About. People care about potholes, litter, dog poo,
mess,
bin collections,
bins,
street lighting.
Speed cameras people don't like, ULEZ.
That's where
20-mile-an-hour limits.
That's where politics actually intersects with people's lives.
Old people.
We could go on to Robert's favourite, like the picnics. We don't like picnics, do you? We could do a whole list, Elton John.
We're not going to fall out about Elton John again. So, Ben, you genuinely, did it happen as a result of you playing golf on the potholes, got it resurfaced?
Yep, so... I spoke to a couple of local council members and they said it made a very big difference and put the pressure on the council.
So are you available to hire? You could go around the country playing golf in people's potholes and then you could get them resurfaced.
Yeah, like doing a little tour around the country, doing potholes and covering them all. So I have thought about that.
It's a paradox though, isn't it? Because in victory, he lost his golf course.
Mm.
But it's a price worth paying, presumably.
Well,
looking at some of the pictures, they are massive potholes that you're now fishing in.
Yeah, they are big ones, and especially some of them alongside the road in Malmesbury, alongside when it rains, they splash people because the pavements are so small, and they've got nowhere else to go as well.
Oh, yeah, look, I can see where you're sitting. So you've got, like, massive potholes along the side of the road, a very narrow pavement, and then some iron railings. So if there's a car coming along there...
When does a pothole just become a hole? I mean...
Or when does it become a wild swimming pond?
If it's deep enough to have fish in, isn't it just like a hole? Like in Florida when the ground opens up.
I don't
want to
spoil the magic, Robert, but I don't think there's any fish in these holes.
Oh, really?
No.
These are just holes in the road. And for publicity purposes, he's fishing.
Oh, I thought there might be like little tidbits.
So if you get these refilled, what are you going to do next? What? You've done golf, you've done fish. What else could you...
I think wild swimming is the answer, isn't it? I think you're going to have to strip off.
Ben, you're going to have to get your chunks on.
I was thinking I have to get my mum to go swimming in one.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, send your mum, that'll work. Well, Ben, will you let us know if they fill the fishing rod holes? Will you come back and tell us?
Yeah, I sure will.
That's what we'll be like. We're getting potholes filled one by one across the country. Lovely to speak to you, Ben. Take care.
Thank you.
Cheers, bye-bye.
Bye.
I thought we should go and fish now, shouldn't we? We should go and get some little goldfish and put them in.
Or like hook a duck or something.
Hook a duck. Hook a duck. That's what he ought to be doing.
Yeah, I used to love hook a duck because it was actually easy. Wasn't one of those things you could actually do.
No, it's not. It's for children, though, isn't it, really? It's for children still struggling with, you know...
No, even for kids, it's pretty easy, is it?
Okay. Alice Thompson and Robert Crampton, then, of course, you'll read them in The Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription at thetimes.co.uk. Up next, it's classic PMQs Unpacked.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Order!
Order! Order! I call Matt Chorley and Patrick Maguire.
Yeah, we thought we'd bring you another edition of Classic PMQs Unpacked. Over the past couple of weeks, we've done Major versus Blair from January 1997. Last week was Blair versus Haig from the year 2000. This week, we are heading back to 2005.
Stand before you as the first leader in the Labour Party's history to win three full consecutive terms in office.
I now declare David Cameron to be the duly elected leader of the Conservative Party.
It is a huge privilege and an honour and a great responsibility to take on this job.
I'm going to choose Conservative Party, so I won't be scared when I go out at night.
I will choose the Conservative Party so that I can get on with teaching rather than simply trying to keep order.
The leadership of Hogie and Ahern has formally ordered an end to the armed campaign. This will take effect from 4 p.m. this afternoon. All IRA units have been ordered to dump arms.
It's denounced the death of His Holiness Pope John Paul II.
Good afternoon from Windsor. About 12:30, Charles and Camilla will arrive here for their civil ceremony here in the Guildhall.
Oh, that takes about, the year 2005 when King Charles married Camilla. The Killers were top of the charts and the first video ever was uploaded to YouTube. Well, today we're going all the way back to Wednesday, the 7th of December, 2005, the day after David Cameron became leader of the Conservative Party. The front page of The Times that day, I've got it in front of me, The Great Gamble, it says. The Conservatives yesterday staked their future on David Cameron, the most inexperienced person to become leader of a British political party since William Pitt the Younger. Mr. Cameron, at 39, faces Tony Blair across the dispatch box at question time today after becoming the 26th leader of the Conservative Party. He scored a decisive victory over David Davis, beating the Shadow Home Secretary by more than 2-1. He got 134,446 votes to David Davis's 64,398.
This piece goes on. In a swift illustration of his determination to reclaim the centre ground for the Conservatives, he broke with the legacy of Thatcherism, declaring there was such a thing as society and promised a new style of politics that would mean the Tories backing the government if they thought it was the right thing for the country. He also told his party to stop grumbling and to accept modern Britain as it was. He said he wanted to end Punch and Judy politics, the name-calling, backbiting, point-scoring and finger-pointing. Well, as the Times reported on the 7th of December 2005, the first test of the end of Punch and Judy politics came with his first appearance at PMQs, the fifth Tory leader. Amazing when you think about that. The fifth Tory leader to face Tony Blair. It says he was in deep consultation with his aides, debating whether to use his first appearance at PMQs to reflect a more consensual attitude or to attack Tony Blair over the pre-budget report and Europe. Well, let's find out what happened then as we head to the House of Commons for the first time. This is from Wednesday, the 7th of December, 2005. The Commons Speaker, Michael Martin, is in the chair.
Order. Questions to the Prime Minister, Stephen O'Brien.
Question number one, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, sir, this morning I had meetings with ministerial colleagues and others. In addition to my duties in the House, I will further such meetings later today.
So there we are, Tony Blair there. So let's kick off with question number one. We're going to the House of Commons. This is, remember, David Cameron's only been Tory leader for, what, 24 hours, barely that. Let's go to the House of Commons. Question number one from David Cameron.
David Cameron. Yeah!
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The first issue that the Prime Minister and I are going to have to work together on is getting the good bits of his education reforms through the House of Commons and into law. That's the problem with these exchanges. The chief whip on the Labour side shouting like a child.
That's Hilary Armstrong, the Labour's chief whip, he's talking to. So much for the end of Punch and Judy politics.
No. Has she finished? Have you finished? Right. We both agree that schools with greater freedom produce the best results. Will he confirm that all of the freedoms for schools in the white paper will survive into the bill?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, it is important that we give schools the freedoms that they need, and I'm delighted to hear that he supports these reforms. I assume, therefore, the Conservative Party will be voting for them.
Tony Blair there. And David Cameron said he wanted to end Punch and Judy politics, and then immediately started having a go at Labour's chief whip, Hilary Armstrong. The issue that they were discussing, trust schools, that takes me back. This was the idea that independent state schools would essentially be independent. They could do their own thing but remain within the state sector. Listening along to that, as somebody who's been watching PMQs probably even longer than me, is Andrew Jimson, biographer of Boris Johnson, sketch writer too. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, hi.
Can you remember what trust schools were all about?
Not really, no. They're very important at the time.
It's basically academies, I think is what we now call academies, but they were called sort of trust schools at the time.
Yes.
So David Cameron uses his first PMQs to actually do quite a clever thing. Tony Blair, in his sort of the tail end of his premiership, was going all out on the reforms. He wanted his legacy, you know, shaking things up.
Yes.
Some of his own MPs didn't really like it. And David Cameron says, be as bold as you like, I'll support you.
Yes, that was very astute of Cameron. Of course, Cameron had been a backroom boy since he left Oxford, so he had done a lot of helping other Tory leaders to prepare for it. But yes, it was still a very good a good way of coming at it. Yeah, yeah.
And actually, he was shadow education secretary immediately before, so it's also sort of the area that he probably knew best. Well, let's go back then. So we've had, I'll support you all the way. I'll support you all the way, Tony Blair, tried niggling. Let's go back to the House of Commons. This is question number two from David Cameron.
Absolutely. With our support, with our support, the Prime Minister knows there is no danger of losing these education reforms in a parliamentary vote. So he can afford to be as bold as he wants to be. Yeah. That's when he's at his best. Now, or so I'm told. Now, can we agree that that means trust schools, owning their own buildings and land, employing their own staff, setting pay locally, developing their own culture and ethos, and controlling their own admissions?
Of course, it means all those powers that presently are available to foundation and voluntary aided schools being extended to other schools as well. That's the purpose of the proposals. Incidentally, I should have, before I answered any question, welcomed him to his new position and congratulated him on winning the Conservative leadership election. But can I tell him where I feel we may, and I'm sorry to say this, have a disagreement. And that is, as I understand it, his position, though, is to say that all schools should be free to set their own admissions procedures. I'm afraid I believe the present admissions code should remain in place. So perhaps we could just clear up that too.
Yeah. Bit rude that, Andrew, that Tony Blair forgot to welcome David Cameron to being Tory leader.
Yes, he was quite graceful in the way he retrieved that, I think. And it is very funny, actually, to hear Cameron putting Blair on the back foot. One's reminded how good Cameron was at this sort of stuff. Because Blair, of course, is very, very good at it. I mean, Blair was a tremendous Commons performer and very, very good at the sort of self-deprecating joke when he was in a tight spot and things. Trying to lever open this gap between Blair and the Labour Party it's a very profitable. Who knows? I just think we'll be seeing that with Keir Starmer before very long, assuming he becomes Prime Minister before very long.
It's interesting that difference. Because Keir Starmer tries to do it sometimes with Rishi Sunak, but sort of slightly less successfully. It's sort of because he doesn't want to support, I suppose the big difference is David Cameron agreed with Tony Blair, which is Tony Blair didn't agree with his own MPs. But there probably aren't many things that Keir Starmer could say that he agreed with Rishi Sunak on necessarily. Let's go back to the House of Commons. So we've just had Tony Blair asking David Cameron if he would clear up where he stands on admissions at schools as he tries to create top of him. So does David Cameron answer that question?
I want schools to control their own admissions. That's what's in the white paper. And let's see it turns into the bill. It's only our first exchange, and already the Prime Minister is asking me the questions. This approach is stuck in the past, and I want to talk about the future. He was the future once. Education is one of the public services in desperate need of reform. So will he agree with me that our aim should be to make sure that all schools have these freedoms? Will the Prime Minister ensure that this is one reform where he won't look back and wish he'd gone further?
Well, I certainly can say, as I said before, that it's important that all schools get these freedoms. However, it is obvious that we disagree on the issue of admissions. I think that if schools are free to bring back selection at the age of 11, that would be regressive for our country. And so I'm afraid in this grand new consensus we have to disagree on that point. The other point, though, that I think is very important is this. We've also got to keep the investment going in our schools. Now, as he knows, the Conservative Party voted against that investment. But I have to say it's that as a result of the investment and the change through specialist schools and city academies and the literacy and numeracy strategy, we've now got the best ever results at 11, at 16, at 18 in our schools. And therefore, I have to say to him that it's not merely in respect of education policy we've got to agree. We've also got to agree that the investment that is so necessary to back up that reform continues. And I'm afraid his economic policy, which is actually to cut back investment because of his desire. Yes. Well, I'm happy if this is another policy he's about to change. But he is saying that this year he would not have put all the investment in, but rather have shared that investment half and half between tax cuts and investment. As a result of that, that would mean substantial cuts in public investment. And therefore, I'm very happy to have this new consensus with him, and I'm delighted that today he said the Conservative Party will vote for these education reforms, but it has to be on the basis, I'm afraid, of agreeing the investment also.
Yeah. Blimey, it was a long-winded exchange, if nothing else, there, Andrew. That the main, obviously, it's interesting because it was the first time that David Cameron was there. But that line, this approach is stuck in the past. I want to talk about the future. He was the future once. I mean, what a line! Your first outing at PMQs.
It's a beautiful line and very well delivered. Obviously, very carefully prepared. But then, of course, Cameron had got the leadership by being able to give speeches without notes. And that gives you a kind of freedom, which actually, and Starmer always has his notes there, which is a pity. He doesn't sort of put the notes away, and one can almost always speak better without notes. Cameron is a deservedly celebrated jibe the young challenger and the aging.
And then he used it, didn't he? When David Cameron then stood down, he said, "I was the future once."
Yes, he did. Yes,
when he finally left in the
yes, although that was quite graceful too.
He turned out that his future wasn't over. He's back again now as Foreign Secretary. Well, let's take some of the best of the best. Little known Labour MP called Sadiq Khan asked a very togian question about how marvellous the hospitals were in his constituency, and Tony Blair agreed they were marvellous. But let's go now to the leader of the Liberal Democrats, Charles Kennedy.
Charles Kennedy.
Mr. Speaker, the United States Secretary of State yesterday said that extraordinary rendition had been conducted in cooperation with European governments. To what extent, therefore, has his government cooperated in the transport of terrorist suspects to Afghanistan and elsewhere, apparently for torture purposes?
First of all, let me draw a very clear distinction indeed between the idea of suspects being taken from one country to another and any sense whatever that ourselves or the United States or anyone condones the use of torture. Torture cannot be justified in any set of circumstances at all. The practice of rendition as described by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has been the American policy for many years. We've not had such a situation here, but that has been the American policy for many, many years. It, however, must be applied in accordance with international conventions, and I accept entirely her assurance that it has been.
Patrick McGuire, can you remember what extraordinary rendition was? It was one of the... It really took me back, that.
Yeah, it was the process by which the United States used to move terror suspects from one country to another in order to circumvent that country's laws on torture. So if you wanted to give a robust interrogation, as the CIA might say, to a terror suspect, you would fly them to a country, another country, and do it there. And there was a big controversy at the time, of course, because Labour ministers had worked with the US government in letting flights land at UK airports, and the European Union let them use EU airspace, had a sort of blanket approval for that, allowing them, the US, to fly any flight that had anything to do with counter-terrorism over its territory. And in that exchange, you see a situation for the Labour Party that's quite similar to what's happening now, i.e. you have a challenger staking out ground to its left and attacking its compromises and Atlanticism on foreign policy. And that was so fruitful for Charles Kennedy over Iraq. You're seeing him stake out the same sort of territory here.
And he was, you know, he's absolutely riding high. He just won the most seats of the Lib Dems ever had.
Yeah, 62, wasn't it?
Yeah, 62. He also went down when Nick Clegg then went into the 2010 election. Andrew Jimson, somebody's just messaged in saying, listen to Blair and Cameron, it's clear how far we have sunk in recent years. They're actually talking about policy responding to each other. How sad. Is that just rose-tinted spectacles, or has the nature of PMQs changed, do you think?
I think they do seem greater in retrospect. That they often seem rather trivial at the time.
People watching that think, we do remember the days of Thatcher and Kinnock or whatever it might be. Let's go back.
Certainly, Disraeli was a great man.
Well, you remember him well, of course, Andrew.
good friend of yours. Let's go back to the House of Commons then. So it's really interesting. People who listen to PMQs normally, Keir Starmer will do all of his questions in groups of six. It is what lots of leaders of opposition do. When David Cameron came in, he'd do this thing. He'd sort of split. He'd do some sort of political knockabout to start with, and then he'd basically do a slightly worthy question, which is what happened here. Question number four, he let some other MPs have some questions. Then David Cameron came back. This is from, again, December 2005. David Cameron came back with this as question four.
David Cameron.
The Montreal Climate Change Conference is taking place this week. We support the goal of a new Kyoto-style treaty which will tackle carbon emissions. Earlier this year, the Prime Minister said, and I quote, he has been changing his thinking on this issue. Can he set out his new thinking? And in particular, is he still committed to a proper successor to Kyoto based on clear targets, including all the major carbon-producing countries of the world?
Yes, I certainly am committed to that. And the reason why I think it is important that we change our thinking on this is that I don't believe that the successor to Kyoto can work unless it has not just the United States involved in such targets and such a framework, but also India and China, because they are the major emerging economies of the world. In China, for example, at the moment, they're building somewhere in the region, I think it's one power station every week or every 2 weeks. And therefore, unless we manage to get a comprehensive framework that also involves India and China, then it won't be of much use to us. And so I entirely agree that it is an immensely important issue. That's one of the reasons, of course, why we passed the climate change levy. And I hope this now indicates also that he will support us on this too.
Blimey, that takes me back. He wasn't quite hugging a husky just yet, but David Cameron used it. You know, it was quite novel for the leader of the Tory party to be talking about the Montreal climate change conference.
Yeah, COP 11, that's how far back in history we've gone here, Matt. And it is interesting, as you say, for a Tory leader to be leaning into multilateral agreements on climate and demanding more action from a Labour government. You know, as you say, that was a big part of David Cameron's rehabilitation of his own image, of the Conservative Party's image. It's also interesting as well in Blair's response there, the perennial questions that still dog these debates, i.e. what's the point if you can't get the likes of India and China around the table signing up to these agreements? It's quite a prescient response to that from Tony Blair, in that it foreshadows the big divides in these international negotiations that still happen today.
And Andrew, a reminder of the way that David Cameron was using PMQs, which is a very Westminster bubble thing, and actually more so than even now, it does feel like a conversation happening in Westminster which we're just listening in on. There's not a lot of context setting, or, you know, there's an assumption you know what the Montreal is or what trust schools are. But was using it as part of that early rebrand. I remember he was doing this, you know, he'd also ask about, you know, foreign aid questions, climate change, the situation in Africa. You know, it was all part of him showing he was a different type of Tory.
Yeah, no, he does it very well, I think. But Blair responds pretty well too. And as Patrick said, makes that point about India and China, which will occur to anyone, but it's better to make it for him to make it than for it to be made to him. But you do feel that Cameron is somehow trying to dig a deep trap for Tony Blair, and Blair knows he's got to proceed with a certain degree of caution and mustn't just agree to everything.
But you sort of can't help but think, sort of, even though David Cameron's new in the job, it's sort of two people on the top of their game. Cameron knows exactly what he's doing. Blair knows what he's doing and try to avoid it. And as a result, it feels like, you know, something might happen, which is often not the case at PMQs. To round off this classic edition of PMQs Unpacked, we can now go back to the House of Commons. A very important question from the MP for Taunton, Jeremy Brown.
Jeremy Brown.
Like many market towns, Taunton suffers from chronic traffic congestion that harms the environment, business, and the quality of life of local people. What measures can the government take to tackle this problem, both in Taunton specifically and in hundreds of other towns across Britain?
Well, first of all, I do understand that Somerset County Council, which is the local transport authority for Taunton, received over £20 million this year for local transport, and that's an increase of over 20% in the last few years. And I know that they've indicated that congestion in Taunton will be a priority. There are new powers now that have been given to towns under the Traffic Management Act, including the ability to coordinate utility and telecom companies' roadworks and covering parking enforcement, bus lanes, and indeed even some moving traffic offences. And I have to say that I think in the end it's our job to provide the powers and the money. It's the job of the local authority to make the best use of that. And I hope Taunton is able to do that. They obviously face a problem of congestion, as do many towns, but they do have additional powers and they have additional resources.
Andrew, I think that might have been proof of your adage that it's better to not speak from notes. What's more with feeling, Prime Minister?
He saw the question coming. Rather, I like Jeremy Brown's tone of voice, actually, because he sounds like a sort of rather old-school Tory, but there he is as a Lib Dem.
Well, that's how that's how he won my hometown of Taunton, of course, essentially pretending to be... presenting anyway as a Conservative, and actually quite a lot of his Lib Dem colleagues thought so when he ended up in government too. But a sign, Patrick, that was, you know, PMQ's doing its job even back then. I would suspect that even though he's a Lib Dem, I suspect Jeremy Brown had told Number 10 he was going to ask about, and he might have even ended up on the front of the Taunton Times.
With a Matt Chorley byline.
Well, I was thinking, actually, I'd left the Taunton Times by that point. I was reporting on PMQ's...
I joined the gallery
a few weeks earlier, in like October, I think, 2005.
And there was your top contact, grilling the Prime Minister.
On my very first day, when I started working in Westminster, on my very first day, I went and sat in the gallery just to be shown how it worked.
The smell of the grease paint, roar of the crowd.
Start practicing my shorthand. And Jeremy Brown was in the chamber. It was quite late. It was like a Monday evening. And Jeremy Brown was in the chamber and he looked up and he did the international sign for, do you want a drink? Do you want a drink? Do you want to have a drink? Do you have a drink? And I'd already been told, do not in any way try to communicate or signal, or they're not supposed to acknowledge it. And suddenly there's an MP going, do you want a drink? Should we go for a drink? And I went to the press bar that first night with Jeremy Brown. And he introduced me to two people who were grandees of the lobby who basically ignored me. Well, I won't name them now. It wasn't Andrew Jimson, though. Andrew, lovely to speak to you.
Lovely to speak to you.
Andrew Jimson there. Biographer of Boris Johnson, long-time sketch writer, and he writes for Con Home as well.
That's it for today. We'll have a proper PMQs unpacked next week as Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer return to the Commons. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.